The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, Christmas is a time when many people try to avoid the news, take a break from it. But very often, even at this festive time, there are stories that have universal cut-through. From the fall of Ceausescu to the enactment of our own constitution, some extremely significant events have happened over the festive period. So myself and our political correspondent Sean Defoe are going to take you on a trip to some Christmases past and the news stories that grabbed the headlines, starting with this from December 26th, 2004.
Few understood what was happening back then as they watched the lethal torrent of water roar in. There had been no warnings. Thailand, like Sri Lanka, was a long way from the massive earthquake which sent the wave racing across the Indian Ocean.
So, Sean, the tsunami, it was a massive story.
Huge. It's one of those first really big stories that I remember and really breaking through. I mean, the devastation that followed in the weeks to come and the images that we saw. And like, this was about 8 in the morning, December 26th, Stephen's Day 2004, as you said, 9.1 magnitude earthquake that hit off of Sumatra, the Indonesian island. And, you know, the images of those waves, they're almost still burnt into your head watching Sky News or whatever channel you had on at the time of them. And over the next 7 hours, really, those tsunami waves went out from the epicentre. Huge death toll across 15 countries, 228,000 people died. Indonesia, Sri Lanka, India, the Maldives, Thailand, they were some of the ones that had massive damage. And I mean, the death toll in Indonesia alone was the majority. It was about 200,000 people.
Now, I had a personal account from the tsunami because one of my colleagues at the time in RT, Bill Malone, was actually in Thailand when the tsunami struck.
Wow.
And ended up, I think they were getting ready to take the sun on the beach, himself and his then girlfriend, now his wife. I think the tsunami prompted him to pop the question. But anyway,
when you've been through something like that, I suppose.
I mean, they almost lost their lives, but they managed. They ended up like naked on the side of the road, blood gushing down from Bill's leg, you know, seriously injured. Took him quite a while to recover, but it gave us a first-hand sense of how awful it was. And of course, it prompted a huge aid effort from this country to those benighted countries that had been so affected.
It was massive. There was so much fundraising going on, and it just stuck really in the psyche, maybe because of that we had personal stories, Irish and British, throughout the time that we're going back through it. But there was really this big effort on to help, documentaries and programs made from over there. And it changed the way that we forecast these things as well, didn't it? There was a new tsunami warning and mitigation system set up in 2005 to try and predict these. But also even just how many movies or adaptions or TV shows have you seen since that have basically taken the footage from that particular event and made it into, all right, a fictionalized version? But it's become that image burned in and terrifying for anyone who went through it. And people, obviously lots of people lost people in it as well.
Well, I went over to Sri Lanka myself a year afterwards to see what was happening in the recovery effort. And it's amazing. Everywhere we went, there were pictures of donations from Irish charities,
right?
You know, St. Patrick's this and St. Mary's that and St. Declan's the other. It was quite extraordinary.
And what was that rebuild like? Because obviously a lot of the buildings that are there wouldn't be built to maybe the standards that we'd think of over here. So you can take that two ways. One, they were very easily blown away, but also I imagine relatively quick to rebuild in part.
Relatively quick to rebuild. And of course, people had lost their livelihoods. You know, boats were destroyed, so fishermen had to find a new way to make a living, and schools were destroyed, so the recovery, it took years and years and years. And there was a tendency to say, well, that's that part of the world, we don't have those kind of problems. Kind of that's the third world. But of course, these kind of things can happen.
Well,
they could happen
pretty much anywhere. Possibly less likely for us on the very edge of an ocean, or an ocean as deep as the Atlantic. But we've seen tsunamis since, not to that same scale, that have done awful damage.
We'll go back in time now to 1914 and the famous Christmas truce.
This is one of those ones. I went to school in England for a while. I was born there. And this was one of those ones that was sort of just lionized and mythologized. The Christmas Truce, 1914, middle of World War One. And it's sort of remarkable to think that the war in Ukraine is now going almost as long as the entirety of World War One. Christmas Eve, the English side, as it is reported, in part of, and because of course these trenches went for, you know, hundreds of kilometres, so it wasn't every part of it, but heard from the German trenches, carols being sung, could see little fir trees had been put up, and there was this sort of tentative backwards and forwards. You can almost imagine it, the first people to put their head above the parapet and above the trenches and go out into no man's land strewn with the barbed wire and the maybe unexploded bombs and landmines. And there was this truce, and of course the famous game of football as well.
Yeah. Now the question is, true or false, myth or fact?
I think mostly fact. Unless you're about to tell me the football, you're about to break my bubble here, is it?
And it's actually I'm just wondering to what extent, you know, it happened in one place and then it's been mythologized as happening all along the front.
It's a bit like the gig that 1,000 people attended and suddenly 60,000 people there. It definitely wasn't. And there were people killed on Christmas Day, that particular Christmas, at other parts of the line. A lot of the officers were dead against this because, of course, they're trying to encourage these people to go out and kill each other the next day.
They can't humanize them, which is what these kind of encounters did. They humanize the troops on both sides. So how can you kill your brothers?
Exactly. But I mean, a lot of them did go back to killing each other and in the days past. It's sort of this really weird psychological event in history where, yes, it shows the best part of humanity in a way, and that these were people who were part of a bigger machine, who were maybe you know, the meat grinder of war, and yet they came together for this truce. But ultimately, they did go back to shooting each other a few days later.
Well, I will jump forward again to another Christmas, and this time it's to Christmas Eve 1968.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. God divided the light from the darkness. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
So that was Apollo 8 orbiting the moon. I mean, we had to wait half a year for the moon landing later, but this was in 1968 and they got to see the dark side of the moon.
Yeah, I went around it a number of times. Frank Borman, Jim Lovell and Bill Anders, not quite as famous as Armstrong and Collins. And I was going to say Lightyear for a second. Buzz Aldrin, of course, they're the different Buzz that I'm thinking of there. But this was a few months before that. There was a big pressure on, of course, that goal that had been there for the Americans to reach the moon by 1970 was under pressure, and this mission, the Apollo 8 mission, went up there, as you heard there, recited Genesis as they went around, took turns reading from the book of Genesis as they beamed back that image of the moon and Earth. NASA had decided to change the mission plan pretty late on to get them up there. This wasn't always intended to be done when it was. Went into orbit on the 21st of December, circled the moon 10 times, and on Christmas Eve was time to come home, landed down, I think, December 27th, it was just after Stephen's Day, into the Pacific Ocean with that famous line, "Roger, please be informed, there is a Santa Claus."
Oh, the Americans.
They know how to do drama.
They know how to do drama. So, and the worry was, of course, re-entry. I mean, getting the guys back home safely. Had that not been a safe landing, well, the whole program, the lunar program, would have been scrapped.
Yeah, remarkable to think just six months later what was to come. If you believe, of course, that they did land on the moon, Pat, maybe this was all part of the conspiracy.
If the program been scrapped, there would be no conspiracy either. So there you are. Capricorn won the movie. I don't know whether you ever saw that terrific movie about that very thing. We go back in time again, this time to December 23rd, 1920. Now, what is important about that date?
1920, we're going back to essentially the foundation of the state here and the document that would found it, the Government of Ireland Act 1920. On the 23rd of December that year, it was given royal assent, essentially given the nod through having passed through both houses of the British Parliament, and this was to create two parliaments on the island of Ireland, the six counties and the 26 county one. So essentially, I mean, this is, and you can, the way you even phrase it depends on your worldview, I suppose, doesn't it? This is partition, or this is foundation of the state, or this is either way a momentous act in the history of Ireland.
One way or the other, it is a foundational document.
Mm-hmm. Completely. Yeah. Foundational for our history. And after a very turbulent decade in Irish politics, obviously 1916, before that even Home Rule, everything that went before World War One, to go back to that, how that changed perspectives in Ireland on what should be done and what could be done and the attitudes there. So regardless of your political view and whether you say that this is the document that ultimately enshrined the fact that we don't have a united Ireland, a one island Ireland, but it did also create the Free State.
And chief among the objectors was a man called Joseph Devlin, who'd taken over from John Dillon as leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party after Dillon's defeat in 1918. And he said, how has this government proceeded to deal with this question of minorities? They have placed the Protestant minority in the 26 counties in Ireland absolutely at the mercy of the Catholic majority. And my friends and myself, 340,000 Catholics in the 6-county parliament, covering a population of 1.2 million, are to be left permanently and enduringly at the mercy of the Protestant parliament in the north of Ireland. And of course, Carson in favour of the bill. But, I mean, that was prophetic in a way, that the gerrymandering that followed, the lack of proper representation for the minority population, that ensued and gave rise to the Troubles and ultimately, of course, the Good Friday Agreement. But
yeah,
you can see the beginnings of it all there.
Completely. And it's really interesting to read that through the history of today. And perhaps we take for granted how significant the events of the last couple of years, and Michelle O'Neill is the First Minister now in Northern Ireland, that that Protestant majority has sort of been eaten away at. And we're talking now about a united Ireland whenever that referendum will come. But you're right, completely prophetic statement that is only now, nearly more than 100 years later, coming about to change.
Now, the Constitution, this is again a Christmas document, Bunreacht na hÉireann, 29th of December 1937. What happened?
Yes, something about Christmas and these foundational documents, Pat. I don't know why they're all coming around this time of year. But as you said, 29th of December 37, Constitution of Ireland came into force. It was approved by 56.5% of voters in a vote that happened on the 1st of July that year, drafted by John Hearn. He was a legal advisor with supervision and fairly hefty involvement of Eamon de Valera. The Constitution established that the name of the state is Éire, or in the English language, Ireland. Also controversially claimed that the national territory consists of the whole island of Ireland, which was seen as deliberately provocative to unionists, and obviously that was dropped as part of the Good Friday Agreement negotiations and referendum as well. So our constitution that has been much changed since, but a very heavy Catholic influence on it, one that we're maybe still grappling with some of the
consequences. I mean, it gave particular reference to the special position of the Holy Catholic, Apostolic and Roman Church as the guardian of the faith professed by the great majority of the citizens. So it was a Catholic document for Catholic people.
Completely. This was Eamon de Valera through his viewpoint. And there's a lot of argument to say that a lot of what is in the constitution is quite archaic. Maybe that's natures of constitution. There's a lot of row at the minute, I suppose, about renaming and about history and all the rest of it. History is written at the moment for the people of the moment. Probably would have been very acceptable, and clearly was, to the people of Ireland at that time, but it's a very different world we're in now.
Now we're going to leave the island and head east, and we're going to what used to be the old Soviet Union, which encompassed many of the countries of Eastern Europe. And of course, they were all under Moscow's maw, really. And then Gorbachev came along, and we had Glasnost and Perestroika, and Hungary, I think, was the first to become liberalized, and people escaped from the Soviet Union via Hungary into the West. But Ceausescu ran Romania with an iron fist. He was a very repressive ruler. But then we go to, what was it, 1989 and December. Let's have a listen.
Romanian brothers, we come here to the Romanian Broadcasting Company to tell you that the dictator has fallen, to let you know that the country is free.
With an angry rooftop mob closing in on them, the Ceausescus panicked and made their escape by helicopter.
It was a stark announcement by the Romanian television announcer. Nicolae Ceausescu and his wife Elena were executed after a trial, they said. They'd been found guilty of genocide, and they were charged also with smuggling huge amounts of money out of the country.
So the demise of the Ceausescus, and it happened really fast. In a matter of days, what looked like a solid communist-run country collapsed.
Yeah, it's remarkable watching some of these things through history, isn't it, that they... what seems so solid for so long can come undone very, very quickly. And it's the fear of a lot of these sort of dictators that will happen. Throughout December 1989, there was a pretty bloody battle playing out in Romania. There had been a revolt, essentially, I suppose, a revolt in the western city of Timișoara that was violently quashed and crushed on Ceaușescu's orders. But it didn't stop there. The dissidents sort of
spread. There was blood
on
the street, and then he organized this mass gathering, which he thought was going to echo support for him. Mm-hmm. But that went badly wrong.
Yeah, he started giving the speech blaming fascist agitators for what had happened in that city in the west, and the Bucharest crowds completely turned at him, started shouting the name of the city, Timișoara, Timișoara, and he tried to appease them. He was promising, I mean, this is a man literally trying to cling on at that stage. He was promising higher wages. He was promising, pretty much anything to try and get him out of trouble. And then in the end, the crowd turned on him, and as you say, or as you heard in that particular clip, the helicopter comes to rescue him and his wife, Elena, and they're, again, go back to that dramatic, it's almost like something out of a Narcos or something.
I mean, they did escape in this helicopter with a couple of bodyguards and the pilots, and then the word came through, all aircraft are grounded, so they had to drop down somewhere. And there they were abandoned with their bodyguards, the pair of them, Mr. and Mrs. Ceaușescu. Mm. Then they were quickly apprehended and up against the wall on Christmas Day.
On Christmas Day,
that was the
executed
end.
By firing squad and the end of the... And the fall, I suppose, of one of those Soviet countries that would probably lead us into our next story.
Yeah, because Gorbachev, he transformed Russia. He had this glasnost, this openness, and perestroika, which is reconstruction, because he recognized, in a way that no other leader had recognized in Russia, that the Russian economy was purely based on the military. Mm. All the money went into military development and nuclear weaponry and so on. Meantime, you couldn't buy a can of beans in the place.
Yeah.
When I was in Moscow before the fall of the wall, I was in the GUM store, which is now lavish and gorgeous and all that. It was just pretty much like the Ivy Market is, but, you know, 40 times bigger, or maybe 100 times bigger. And I saw a queue, and I said to the person through the translator, "What are you queuing for?" She said, "Hats."
"Hats? Hats?"
"Yeah, there's a consignment of hats in." And I said, "Are you going to buy one?" "I'm going to buy 5, she said, "and then I will sell them to my neighbours when I get home."
Wow.
That's how it was.
Okay. So it's literally queuing up for anything to come
for
in.
For anything, yeah. And if you saw the can of beans, it mightn't even have a label on it.
Right.
It would just have a black and white printed thing that said, to their eyes and their reading, beans.
Yeah.
But of course, no pictures of little... rosy beans on the tin.
No,
on the tin.
And what was the public attitude like then? Because we're often wondering what Russia is like now and what the public think of Putin. But like, was there anger? Was it just kind of resignation?
I mean, I think it's fair to say that they were relatively, I won't say happy, but they were content in their lot. I mean, to take the metro, it costs 5 kopecks, and there's 100 kopecks in a ruble. And, you know, you could get, at that time, if there was a real exchange rate, you might get 80 rubles to the dollar. Do you know what I mean? So living was cheap, and everyone had an apartment, and the apartments were heated and so on. So there were elements of the communist ideology, you know, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs.
Mm.
But it was desperately poor. And the cars, I mean, the ladders on the street, more often broken down than otherwise.
It was funny, I was in Bosnia not so long ago, and it's parts of it are still very communist, and it is, you were seeing the ladders go along the street next to Range Rovers. It's like 50-50 between Western society and that old Russian society. But they were, of course, a big part of it. And I suppose the reason we're talking about it is the resignation 30 years ago happened Christmas Day, or more than 30 years ago, 1991, in Red Square, sort of this surprise announcement, the Soviet flag over the Kremlin being pulled down and replaced with what we know now, the Russian Federation tricolour.
That should have ended well, but of course it didn't, because with Yeltsin, then along came Putin, and the rest, as I say, is history.
Yeah, and now it's almost trying to reclaim those glory days that were already in decline with Gorbachev and expanding out. We want Ukraine back, and where after that one?
Now, when we talk about political bombshells, we had our own with the foundation of a new political party.
Yeah, this was the 21st, so that's Saturday, or 20th actually, Saturday just gone of December, and this is the PDs. The Progressive Democrats, 1985.
Founded by the late Desi O'Malley.
While this task may seem daunting to some, I am confident that it can be accomplished with success. Conventional Irish political wisdom may advise against it, as it often does against worthwhile change. To achieve progress in any field, risks must be taken. For myself, I am prepared to take them. No one man or woman can achieve much in politics alone. I am asking ordinary Irish men and women who share my approach to politics and my aspiration to renew our society in a genuinely republican mould to join with me in the Progressive Democrats and to lend their hand to that task.
So it was a brave new adventure by Desi O'Malley. Many people said it couldn't possibly work. You'll be too small. You'll be insignificant. You will fade away. Ultimately, they did fade away, not before they had several party leaders, including Michael McDougall and Mary Harney. But Des O'Malley there, his sworn enemy.
Yeah, conduct unbecoming is the phrase of his autobiography and the phrase that was used to kick him out of Fianna Fáil earlier on that year and the rows they had in the, you know, very excellent book by Gary Murphy, who had to join me on the News Talk Daily podcast a few days ago. We did an in-depth look at this and sort of the legacy of the PDs, because while it came out of, well, you know, their viewpoint was really quite different, socially quite liberal, you could argue economically quite liberal as well, sort of a small state, cut taxes. And we were having the argument, is that viewpoint represented anymore in Ireland? Is there a party that encompasses that? Maybe independents have taken it over and the political system has split so widely, particularly over the last 10 years and since 2011. But that was really started by the PDs, who were the first of the small parties to get into power and in successive governments have quite an influence.
Now, over the years, we've lost many people over Christmas, many things that people will recall themselves. But one that I particularly recall was that accident that happened to Michael Schumacher, the Formula One legend. That happened on the 29th of December 2013. He was skiing with his son and went to help somebody off-piste and fell and hit his head.
Absolutely tragic, and people will remember him as this legend, this icon of Formula One racing. And as you say, he was off-piste, the skiing accident in the French Alps. He was only 44 years old, airlifted to Grenoble Hospital at the time and put into an induced coma for a number of months. And really, unfortunately, there's not a happy ending here. He did live, but we have very, very little information on his current condition. It doesn't seem that he leaves his home in Switzerland much. And some reports, how accurate they are, we don't really know, suggest that really verbally is not how he communicates at all anymore. So just tragically sad. And like that, you do see to see, like, I'm trying to think, there's other deaths that have happened over Christmas. George Michael, probably one of the most recent. There just does seem to be something about this time of year, unfortunately, you get a tragedy.
It's so poignant. Well, Michael didn't die. In fact, I had met Michael in Dublin. He came over on a visit when he was the number one driver on the Ferrari team, along with Eddie Irvine, who was living here at the time, who was his co-driver. Met the man. He was very charming, I have to say. And I felt his injury and his incapacity all the more keenly because I'd actually met the man. Anyway, so many things happen at Christmas. We're looking forward to a quiet and peaceful one, but you never know, Sean.
You never know. Having worked in newsrooms over Christmas, and thankfully I'm due to be off. I say due to because you never know quite what'll happen. There's always something that'll keep you busy. But look, we've had enough. We've had quite a bit. I've got a show going out on St. Stephen's Day, charting the top 50 stories of the year. And even just doing the mind exercise of that, we've had a lot this year. Would you a break, Pat?
Sean Defoe, our political correspondent and host of the Let Me Explain podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Emil.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.